The Eucharist is a sacrament, or Holy Communion, and the Eucharist is a sacrifice, or the sacrifice of the Mass. Pretty well summarized in the Adorote of Thomas Aquinas, which is his piece of poetry. He has written very little poetry. This is one of his best known pieces, in which the whole, you might say, gamut of after the Eucharistic species are consecrated, it is believed that Christ is present there, really, in the sense that it is not merely some virtue of him, nor is he present merely spiritually, but bodily. So that the only real objective difference between his presence there and his presence, say, in heaven, is the fact that it does not impinge on the senses. But objectively, ontologically, all that makes Christ Christ is believed to be present under the species. Species are called the elements. Appearances alone remain. The substance has been changed. Now in 621 and 22, and elsewhere too, in there particularly, Aquinas briefly analyzes the nature of that presence. And he stresses on the one hand that Christ is not present there, as say he was present in his physical, visible manner during his mortal or even his immortal life, because there is no impingement on the senses. Nevertheless, every particle of the elements contains the whole Christ. You break the elements, Christ is there. You break them again, he is still present. Behind the presence, however, is something that bears a little analysis. The ordinary word transubstantiation, which has been defined by Trent, in fact, it was used by Aquinas, but defined by Trent to describe the nature of the change. That is well worth rereading what Aquinas says, because not infrequently it is believed that with a change of substance, say from bread and wine into the substance of Christ's body and blood, that is all that is there, as though, well, under the elements is present the body and blood of Christ as far as their substance goes, but that's all. As a matter of fact, the whole Christ is present, and whole means not only substance, but also what are called physical properties. The term that Aquinas uses, and has been used ever since, to describe the way in which the rest of Christ is present, is called concomitance. So that although the immediate effect of the change through consecration is to change the substance of bread and wine into the substance of Christ's body, nevertheless, it is not only the substance of his body which is there, but also all the physical properties which he has, not excluding his quantity. And in fact, in theology, when we analyze this thing philosophically, how is it possible for the quantity of a body to be there when evidently it does not have actual extension, which it doesn't have? Christ's body is not actually extended in space under the Eucharistic elements. Nevertheless, that which makes quantity quantity is there. All the physical properties and qualities, his features, his body with all of its accidents, as we call it, are there. Consequently, through the words of consecration, the immediate effect is to produce the substance of Christ's body and blood. But by concomitance, meaning what? Meaning that if you have a living body, it must have, of course, where the body is, the blood must be there, and vice versa. Where the human nature is, or where the substance is, the accidents must be there, if the whole Christ is present. If the humanity is there, the divinity must also be there, and consequently, everything else. So while the immediate effect of consecration is to produce the substance of Christ's body and blood, the immediate effect immediate, meaning that if this is a living body, it must get all the things that make up a living body, and if it is the whole Christ, then not just his humanity, but also his divinity. And that, some centuries after Aquinas, was defined by the Council of Trent in the very simple two-word statement that after the word of consecration is present, the totus, the whole Christus, Christ. And with that, you have the foundation for the Catholic theology on Holy Communion and on the Mass. As regards Holy Communion, and the passage, by the way, that whole section that Aquinas has on the Eucharist will summarize pretty much what Catholic theology teaches regarding Holy Communion. It is meant, and we saw that lineup of the seven sacraments, as a means of sustaining the spiritual life, which is obtained through baptism. It is sustained through the Eucharist. And the scripture basis for that is, or are the words of Christ, "He that eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life everlasting." Or again, "Unless the man eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, he will not have life in him." Consequently, the sustenance of spiritual or supernatural life is believed to be furnished by the Eucharist. Now, the Council of Trent further specified, it went beyond Aquinas. Not that Aquinas doesn't have a lot of theology on the Eucharist, but it was made definite by Trent. Two effects were conceived. This is Trent now speaking of communion. Both a positive and a negative. Negatively, the effect of the Eucharist is to somehow remove sin. Now, the sin that is removed is not believed to be grave sin. For that, as you will see in a few minutes, Catholicism has the sacrament of penance or confession. But short of grave sin, all other sins are completely removed by communion. So a person does not have to confess them. He may, of course, and it's helpful if he does, but no necessity. And that simple statement, by the way, explains a great deal about the Catholic concept of confession. And whereas Catholicism has more than once been criticized for teaching that it requires its people to confess literally everything they've done, first of all, it's psychologically impossible. Secondly, it's theologically unnecessary. Because the sacrament, whose built-in purpose is to remove both guilt and penalty for sin, is the Eucharist. With the reservation that grave sin is first to be confessed. But now, along with sin itself, and where the sin is short of grave, mortal sin, adultery, grave injustice, and so on, and that is completely removed, depending on the person's dispositions, more or less, depending on how well prepared in spirit he is when he approaches the sacrament. Along with that, there are the effects of sin, whether grave or less than grave. And those effects are, first of all, punishment due to sin. So the penalty is removed. Again, not eternal penalty without prior sacramental confession. But Catholicism believes that every sin has tied to it two elements. It has first the effect of estrangement from God, which is guilt, and the effect of disorder caused by the sin, which is punishment. Now, the punishment part always goes with sin. Never a sin committed without a debt of punishment. It's just unknown to God, so to speak, that he would ever let a sin go by without punishing the sin. There's always a debt incurred. Now, communion is believed to remove more or less of that debt, so that while a person had in store for him, as it were, a certain amount of punishment, of pain, of sorrow, of whatever cross God sends in payment for sin, that is more or less, depending on the disposition, removed by the sacrament of the Eucharist. But along with that, also the effects certain ill effects of sin are removed. And the most important and consequential effect of sin which is removed is concupiscence, unruly passions, unruly emotions. Now this, we know, is a built-in effect as a consequence of the primordial sin of our first parents. In other words, we don't have that control of our appetite, and I don't mean just food or sex, but all kinds of drives that we've got, from mad ambition to dominate and to rule, which is a drive, in some people uncontrollable. Nobody has a built-in control of that, down to the most crude kind of fleshly appetite. All of those, as we know from experience, in the degree to which a person gives into those appetites, they become more and more domineering, until comes a point where they just take over a man, where the habits control a person. Now it is believed, and this, by the way, has been defined by Trent. Aquinas describes it in some detail, but the actual definitive statement was made by Trent, on which Bellarmine then based his theology, that concupiscence has the effect of gradually restoring, depending on the person's disposition, the frequency of his reception, and the fervor with which he receives the Eucharist, has the quality of gradually restoring him, to him that is, that state of integrity that man had before the fall. So that while there is no immediate restoration of integrity on a person's being justified, and we don't have to read a book to know that, all we've got to do is live with ourselves for a while to know what irrational drives we've got. But the irrationality of those drives, or those drives themselves, come to be self-controlled in the degree to which a person has received grace from God, and the main source of that grace, so Catholicism believes, is the Eucharist. And thus it is quite possible for a person, after some years of faithful practice of his faith, now God's grace, don't let me misunderstand, he is not limited to just this channel, but in Catholic theology this is the main single source for developing that self-control, without which, of course, a person wouldn't even keep the moral law. As regarding the Mass, we'll say more when we take up Bellarmine, but just a word now. Behind the possibility of there being a Mass as a renewal of Calvary, and the manner of renewal, and it's not conflicting with Calvary, we'll take a little detail under Bellarmine, but behind it stands the premise that you have present on the altar Christ in the fullness of his humanation. The Mass, which is believed to be somehow a renewal of Christ's sacrifice, would be impossible. In fact, would be unthinkable, unless there were present on the altar a human nature to offer and be offered. And therefore, when we come to explain, without specifically, you might say, arguing the point, in what sense is the Mass, the Eucharist as a sacrifice, a renewal of Calvary? Well, the question arises, what happened on Calvary? And what happened was that you had a human being, so a man, united indeed with the divinity, who first of all offered himself as a priest. And what he offered, the oblation of the victim, was himself. So this was Christ. This was Christ. And his purpose, of course, was redemption. Now, inasmuch as it is believed that present on the altar is Christ, yeah, it all depends on what he does. Since he is there in his human nature, he is capable of renewing if he so desires what he did on the cross, because it's the same priest, and what he offers is himself if he so desires, so the same victim, and the purpose is basically the same, redeeming one case, redeeming the other, with the distinctions to be qualified. The only difference is that in one case the offering was bloody, inasmuch as on Calvary the blood was shed, in the Mass the offering is unbloody. Aquinas developed a theology, Trent defined. Now at this point I thought we would take in some detail before we finish the Eucharist some of Bellarmine's own teaching, and it's as much as we've been reading other people to hear a bit of Bellarmine and how he thought and how he reasoned. As we read Bellarmine, we're going to read him a good deal today. I think it is well to know, first of all, that he is living in a controversial period, and consequently, while he wrote a great deal of positive theology, positive in the sense that he didn't, you might say, just answer objections. Nevertheless, his context is always in the atmosphere of the Reformation. Aquinas was living in, you might say, the ages of faith in the Middle Ages. Meant for all practical purposes, the Western world was both Christian and Catholic. Bellarmine had to take stock of the challenges raised against certain Catholic positions, and consequently, he will express himself in language that is slightly different than Aquinas's. Nevertheless, as has been pointed out by his worst enemies, in the several million words, 2 million words exactly, in his controversial theology, there's not a harsh statement in which he questions sincerity or otherwise, but always the argumentation is on a theological level. So the issue is whether or not by believing that there is a sacrifice of the Mass, that Calvary or the sacrifice of the cross is somehow either injured or inhibited, what in fact makes the sacrifice of the Mass impossible. Now, running as a theme through the early reformers, especially Calvin, right, was a studied effort, and all you've got to do is read the Institutes on the Eucharist. You can't read 5 lines, let alone 50 pages, without seeing how direct and forthright, see, was Calvin's denial of the very possibility of a sacrifice of the Mass. Bellarmine is taking stock of that. Now we won't read all that he has on the subject, just paragraphs here and there. No Catholic, this is Bellarmine, has ever claimed that the priests of the Catholic Church are successors of Christ in the sense that they have taken over or replaced his own sacred priesthood. You see, that in general was the argument. What does Catholicism teach? It teaches that it has a sacrifice of the Mass. Well, of all things. As though Christ's sacrifice was either incomplete or somehow he needs help. On the other hand, to say that men cannot be ordained as vicars and ministers of Christ in a priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek, because this multiplication of priests contradicts the one eternal priesthood of Christ, is simply not true. In other words, to say that Christ, although he is the one eternal high priest, cannot have those who exercise a ministerial priesthood, is to jump the gun and to either misunderstand or misrepresent Catholic teaching. Now here's the way he reasons. For Christ the Lord is not only a priest, but also our unique and eternal teacher. One is your master, Christ. He teaches in the Gospel of St. Matthew. And yet, Christ is no longer our teacher. See, in other words, see the way he's reasoning? Christ is both priest and teacher. How do you say that he cannot have suffragan, ministerial, delegated priests is to really say more than you want to say, because then he also cannot have ministerial, suffragan, delegate teachers, because he insisted he is the one teacher. And yet, as a matter of fact, Christ is not the ordinary, natural, visible way in which we speak of one person teaching another. Are we therefore to conclude that because there are now many human teachers of Christian doctrine, and Calvin, of course, would surely put himself in that class, that category, that therefore the everlasting teaching authority of Christ has gone out of existence? St. Paul, for example, time and again speaks of himself and his fellow workers as doctors and teachers, as vicars and ministers of God. Is the teaching office of Christ made void on this account? The argument, therefore, is that whatever this priesthood of Christ which is exercised in the sacrifice of the Mass, it cannot mean that somehow that which Christ did is incomplete. On the other hand, Christ must want and does want his whole work to continue. And if, therefore, there are those who teach in his name, although he is the one teacher, why should there not be, merely a hypothesis, why should there not be those who also sacrifice in his name?
Sacrifice what, Father?
Sacrifice himself in the sacrifice of the Mass. In other words, he is the one who is offering the sacrifice of the Mass. It is not the priest except as his instrument, no more than when a minister or anyone teaches. Is he teaching in his own name? See, the whole question really, as we can't see too much of this now because it's not our business to go into the ecclesiology of the Reformation, but as I think has been pointed out in the other class in 590, the real issue at stake in standing behind the mentality of those early reformers is a simple denial that Christ really instituted a church. Because if you have any kind of real society which Christ instituted to carry on his work, so that either that society carries on the work of Christ or is up, it doesn't. If it carries on the one, there is no argument in itself for denying that it carries on the other. Thus, if it carries on the work of teaching, why not also the work of sacrificing? And if for 1,500 years it had been doing that, that's the issue, see? Then all the evidence seems to point to Christ's twofold mission being continued, both his mission of teaching and his mission of sacrificing. Now, there's just one more point from Bellarmine. According to John Calvin, I'm quoting Bellarmine, and this, by the way, is drawn from his Institutes, which, as you know, is the main single source of at least Reformed theology. According to John Calvin, it is impossible to erect an altar without tearing down the cross of Christ. And as a consequence, the altars, say in the Netherlands, the Catholic altars were, unless they were not found out, destroyed. And impossible to offer the sacrifice of the Mass without doing injury to the sacrifice of the cross. Now that dilemma is Calvin. The sacrifice of the cross has an infinite value, and therefore he, Calvin, argues, we have no need of any other sacrifice. Can you add to infinity? Consequently, as we multiply the sacrifices of the Mass, we are equivalently denying the infinite power and all sufficiency of the sacrifice of Calvary. Then Bellarmine, and just to get a taste of his approach, I answer with the words of the Apostle Paul when he asks, do we destroy the law through faith? God forbid. Rather, we establish the law. What he said about the law and faith, I say about the cross and the sacrifice of the altar. Do we destroy the cross through the Mass? God forbid. Rather, we establish the cross. Now the question. For how can the mass destroy the cross when the whole power of its existence is to perpetuate the memory of the cross? That's the purpose of the mass. To continue the cross. Now, after this comes the distinction between the purpose of the cross and the purpose of the mass. Both redemptive, so Catholicism believes. Now, Bellamy. I agree with Calvin that the sacrifice of the cross has an infinite value and that it is perpetually effective for the sanctification of men. Infinite and always effective. In fact, for 1,000 worlds and 1,000 human races. From which it follows that there is no more need, now watch this, of another sacrifice of the cross or a repetition of the same sacrifice of the cross. In other words, it is not necessary for another Christ to die for us, or the same Christ to die for us more often. But I deny that it is impossible. Notice it's the question of impossibility. It is impossible without doing justice, injustice, to the sacrifice of the cross, to offer a multitude of other sacrifices which represent the sacrifice of Calvary, and not the operative word. And apply the fruits therein gained. And that's the essence of it. And apply the fruits therein gained for the benefit of our souls. In other words, it is not that the Mass is meant to derogate from the cross, substitute for the cross, repeat the cross, give us another cross, but rather that, and this is the question, is there anything intrinsically wrong, is it prohibited? What's wrong with claiming, believing, that while Christ died and redeemed the world, that the fruits, the benefits of that redemption are singly, specially applied through the sacrifice of the Mass? Then he goes on to explain how, if that were true, then the same thing would hold for the sacrifices of the old law as abominations in the sight of God. So in other words, were the sacrifices of the old law good or bad? Good question. If they were good, whence their goodness? All their goodness derived ultimately from the sacrifice of Christ. And they seemed to be good because they were blessed many, many times in the old law. In fact, commended by God in the old law. So the option that Bellarmine leaves Calvin is a simple one. Either admit at least the possibility of sacrifices which apply, which specify, which channel the benefits of the cross, either admit that possibility or deny all sacrifice in both Old and New Testament. At least you see how the argumentation of Bellarmine. And the issue, therefore, is one which on which Catholicism rests its case for the necessity of a priesthood. In fact, behind Calvin's teaching, as we'll see when we take up the priesthood in more detail, the strongest language in all the Reformation is reserved for the Catholic priesthood. There are passages that I never quote in public from Calvin regarding the priesthood. I always commend my class or students to read them for themselves. And the idea always was that men who call themselves priests are, in the term that he used, those who both blaspheme the gospel and claim that they can bring God, literally God himself, down from heaven on the altar in human form. At any rate, to see how, on the basis of Trent, Bellarmine defended the possibility. After all, the ultimate explanation of any of these is a mystery, and the acceptance of them is a matter of faith. But that they do not derogate from the basic principles of the Christian faith is all that Bellarmine expected to do in the context of what was a very polemic age. You got a question there? Is that Christ is really there? Once he's there, then what happens? See? The intention that Christ has in bringing himself back on the altar
In fact, everything rests on whether he's there. It all depends on that.
But the corner comes to the point is if man or the priests are dispensing of grace, I mean, that's
the Christian unity. And it's a study of the current theological rethinking in the ecumenical movement, among the major Protestant traditions, mainly in Europe, but not only, where the concept of a sacrificing priesthood as part of the ministry is being re-examined. This is based entirely on Protestant sources. In other words, that it is not only the word, but also the sacrament, as a channel of grace. And the hopes for the ecumenical movement, in my mind, are a re-examination, a reassessment on the part of Catholicism, by the way, of a much greater emphasis than it has been placing on preaching and teaching. Right? Much greater emphasis, which the Reformation had very laudably done. But a corresponding discovery, shall we say, or re-emphasis, because many Protestant churches, for example, the Protestant Episcopal Church, see, has a priesthood. Unembarrassed priesthood. And in the ordination ceremony, by ordained priest of God, see, they say it. These are Protestants. See, it was not so alien to the Protestant mind. The point is of building it into the whole complex of Christian theology. And this will take a lot of reassessments. Now we take up the sacraments of penance and then ordinance. First of penance. We go on to what time is it? 8? Now here, first, a brief historical rundown. The word penance or confession is technically used to describe the fourth sacrament in Catholicism, which, roughly as we described it before, is intended to be the means of the forgiveness of sin committed after baptism, and the after baptism ascension is essential because baptism is primarily remissive of sin. One who has been baptized, sinned personally after baptism, has, so Catholicism believes, for his grave sin, the option of using the sacrament of penance. In Augustine's time, there was much less need than, say, much later on for defending the sacrament of penance. It was in vogue, it was used. His main concern was with the Donatists, who, as you know, had broken away from Catholic unity and continued with the seven sacraments. And some of the strongest statements of Augustine are when he tells them that although they go to confession, their sins are not forgiven. Now, it's a little strong in, you might say, from our vantage point, what he is talking about is those who had apostatized and who had broken Christian unity. And therefore, until they had become reconciled with the church through charity, they could hardly expect God to forgive them their sins. Augustine stresses one aspect of penance that is missed sometimes. And in fact, the very word penance indicates it. And it's obvious, whatever a Catholic would find true about the sacrament of penance, he wouldn't find it easy. Now, there might be some people, I have yet to meet them, who just revel and enjoy and can't go often enough. See? In fact, if they get that way, they're usually sent to a psychiatrist. The average person does not like to expose his interior. The normal person. Consequently, the exposure of one's past life, or even of one's recent sinful past, is painful. It is offense. And Augustine stresses the penitential aspect of this self-revelation. And when I hear the argument that Catholics have it easy, all they can do is, well, they sin, then they go to confession, then sin some more, and well, they'd only try it a few times. No. In fact, it's a terrific deterrent. It keeps a person as you would expect from sin. Gosh, I have to tell all about this. It's an added motive, even deterring a person from sinning. It certainly is not a pleasant luxury. It is penitential. And Augustine, who, as we know, was quite a sinner himself and wrote a whole book, disclosing his interior, would know what it meant. And the disclosure, as he says, is easy enough when it is directed to God, and easy enough when it is generic. I am a sinner, says Augustine. Who is it? But when it comes to specify and identify, in Aquinas' case, he developed a theology, and we have, I think it's 629, in about a fairly complete summary of the Catholic theology on the Sacrament of Penance. Our concentration in class will be on Bellarmine, who was a comment on the Sacrament of Penance, so we will examine more of Bellarmine. But a summary of the positive theology is found in Aquinas, and that number given you. And in his case, he followed again pretty much the, well, first of all, he accepted the patristic teaching on this. But he added to it some of the analysis of philosophy, particularly Aristotelian philosophy, especially on the whole business of how do the sins get forgiven? What kind of causality is operating? He was always thinking in metaphysical terms. And he carefully distinguished between a mere declaration that God forgives the sins, so that the priest would be nothing more than, you might say, an innocent or not so innocent bystander, watching what's going on and telling the sinner, well, I guess you've done a good job. You look pretty repentant. God forgives you. Whereas he just stands aside and anybody else, and not only the priest, could make the same declaration. Himself the thing. He distinguished between what he called declarative absolution. He said it was not absolution at all. You declare, in other words, God has forgiven your sins. And the opposite, which is directly remissive absolution, where God Christ uses this human being as a channel so that his mind to be especially his will, I mean the priest. Somehow he's tied in the divinity. Now immediately we see what Bellarmine, question that Bellarmine raised a moment ago. Defense of the Sacrament of Penance. It once said that, regularly said, you don't have to confess your sins to a priest and have a sinner to be a priest. And by which or through which Christ forgives, you just go directly to God. Can God so forgive? Be most certain. So then he has to give the same analogy. Yes, he is. Does he nevertheless use human beings to communicate his message? Well, I hope so. Yes. Has his sacrifice remitted the sins of all men? Yes. Does he nevertheless channel his sacrificial grace through the sacrifice? Well, he said yes. And thirdly, is Christ the Savior? Yes. Does he save all mankind?
Does he receive any sinner who is affected? But then, this is
the hard core of naked Catholicism. See, here we are. And this touches everything which Catholicism teaches. Has Christ, although he is the universal Savior, nevertheless established a church in which he has delegated now his salvific powers to human beings? Catholicism says yes, non-Catholicism says no, and thereby becomes non-Catholicism. Now, Bellarmine, It is an analysis of the theology. There are three things that we want to take up. Lynn, did you notice the time? It's 10 minutes.
10 minute break.
Of analysis, of theological analysis.
The first was that
there is no need of a sacrament of penance because baptism does it. In other words, all that a person has to do is
betake himself to God and he is. Yes. Any future sins.
That was Calvin's argumentation. And the second was a claim that confession, actual or auricular,
that all through your life, then any sin you commit isn't sin?
No. It's a sin, all right. But the remission would come from the recollection of your baptism. See, you think back on the mercy that Christ showed you when you were baptized, your recollection of that, your faith is inspired, thereby you are forgiven again. You see?
And you're going to examine that for me.
Well, that's, of course, let me come. I just wanted to briefly explain. The second was the non-necessity of auricular confession, that is, of actual confession of sins, where somebody with his auras, with his ears, can hear.
And thirdly,
they claim, both by Luther and Calvin, that attrition, the kind of sorrow for sin which is based on the fear of God, was not remissive. Nothing but the love of God could possibly forgive one's sins. Well, just a few paragraphs because we have a lot to see yet. The first, therefore, is just to get a taste again of how Bellarmine approaches the subject.
So here's the here's Bellarmine approaching the subject of penance and
arguing that baptism is not enough, that you need another sacrament besides baptism to obtain forgiveness of sins. Now he said, this is Bellarmine,
well, on the one hand they deny
the reconciliation is possible through sacramental absolution. So in other words, it is not sacramental absolution that remits sins. On the other hand, they had to admit that it took place through one of the sacraments. Well, not necessarily had to admit, but wanted to. See? The sacrament somehow remits sin. Well, the question is, which sacrament is it going to be? So, they taught that baptism is the sacrament of penance. According to the Reformers, I'm quoting Calvin now, those who fall into sin are reconciled through baptism,
necessarily redeemed, yet not really,
but only memorially. And the Latin word is memoriare. Now here's the explanation that the Reformers gave, especially Calvin. It is inconceivable, said Calvin, that God should have made the remission of sins more difficult after baptism than before. In other words, and certainly going to confession is even more difficult than having water poured on you. Again, remission of sins after baptism is as complete a reconciliation to God as baptism itself effects. Since in the first regeneration, all of a man's sins are removed, the same should be said of the second reconciliation, which, of course, according to the Catholics, is never like the first, because not always or necessarily is all the punishment due to sin removed by penance. There is no need, again, Calvin said, for looking for an external symbol instituted by Christ by which the merits of Christ are applied to the remission of sins committed after baptism. Since baptism alone suffices to produce this remission, by being renewed, baptism being renewed, now the word again, conceptually, see, in mind, in faith, in heart, see, in spirit. Well, Bellarmine's answer to that is to go back to tradition and to show how if this were true, if that baptism were to be, as it were, renewed in spirit, you recall the mercy that Christ had on you when you were baptized, when you were justified, if that were all that was necessary, why then, how explain the embarrassing burden of a sacrament of penance, of a confession of sins? Wherever you scrape Christian history before the Reformation, you find it. See? There was no point at which the sacrament of confession was invented. In fact, Bellarmine somewhat critically remarks, no Christian would invent this. He'd know better. In other words, if anyone had attempted to force the confession of sins on the church, unless that church had previously believed this came from Christ, they would never have got away with it. And there's not even the sign of any ripple in Christian history, any claim to innovation. And then Bellarmine appealed to the earliest departures from Catholic Christianity, the Asiatic Nestorians and Monophysites in Asia Minor in the 3rd and 4th centuries, who left the Catholic Church or the Christian Church by denying the divinity of Christ. Yet, they already had confession, and they retained it up to the 16th century when Bellarmine was writing. And on a more dramatic and worldwide scale, Eastern Orthodoxy, which had followed the tradition so completely its own that it was always in conflict with Rome. See? And finally, well, by the 9th century and certainly by the 11th, completely broke with Rome. Nevertheless, it taught and it held to 7 sacraments, including confession, which, with all of its polemic against Rome, could hardly say a kind thing about Rome, see, but never accused Rome of introducing confession. Yet, the Eastern Greek Church believed that its confession was from Christ. So that, in general, is the way Bellarmine handles that position, Mike.
In about the 15th century or 14th century, did a part of the Eastern Church come back to the Catholic?
Yes, in the 15th, 16th centuries, especially in Ruthenia.
But the church that was centered at Constantinople didn't come back?
No, it came back for a while in the 15th century.
Oh, yeah. And is that why the new
church? Yes, in other words, after the takeover, it's a little late. 1554, I think, when under the Muslims, when the monks copied the Ark of the Covenant. And in fact, this is significant, and this shows what changes dramatically in the Catholic Church in the next 10 years. As a condition, re-entrance, shall we call it that, or at least to the Catholic Church being met with Rome, of the Russian Orthodox Church. In the 16th century, they demanded that their priests be married. This is the Orthodox. And they were allowed to come back, they were allowed to become Catholic, and they became the very clergy. Several million, with several thousand. All who were married, that's how we got the marriage. They had broken away and married to the time when there was no law, you know, celibate law in the Catholic Church. Then when the law of celibacy came, that was one of their complaints. You're a celibate. You didn't do before. Which is a long, complex story. In the 15th century, after the Council of Florence, some of the candidates for the Eastern Church.
The requirement was built by Max Thurian. I'm not sure if it's
Max Gurian?
Thurian.
Or Thurian.
And we have these things to relate. They said it quite that our text of Calvin seemed to substantiate and strongly point towards. strongly desirable. And
yes.
In fact, he, you know, did a full backing for
this, no, not necessary, because first of all, this is a highly complex subject. They differ radically on this. See, Luther had confession. And to his dying day, his writings, he's got a book, De Confessione. And you read even the catechism, either the large or the small catechism of Luther, he simply said, and I mean confession of sin. Luther, Calvin, was so concerned about saving the two sacraments, as he called the gospel sacraments, that he wrote polemically against penance and sacrament. But Calvin would absolutely deny, see, the utility. See, it's a question of necessity to be sacrament. Throughout their passages, and I couldn't recall where you would find it in the Institute. Calvin wrote a whole library. I doubt very much if there's anything in the Institute that would give warrant to the reinstatement. But Calvin wrote elsewhere. And it could be, after all, the evangelicals and reform had a lot of problems between themselves before Calvin died. It could be that the evangelicals have softened the Calvinist position to allow at least as an optional confession. And now, even in the Reformed churches, not too many have. Although, incidentally, the Reformed monks in France, the Thésée monks, they have confession. And they're French Huguenots. For that, I think, was more an evangelical innovation. So I would say, if Calvin allows it, and I wouldn't doubt that he might, it would be as an option, but never as an option. All right, the second is the business of confession of sins.
This was the problem of whether or not a person should not only confess to God, but directly confess to a human being who then has power from Christ to pass judgment on your qualifications and give you absolution. Now I'll just, this is a whole section. This, by the way, is my own manuscript, which I've worked with. There are 500 pages that I've translated from Bellum. I have two volumes like this that represent the synthesis of his thought. Now, in the meantime, Trent had defined that confession of sins was necessary. You don't really confess to God, but you confess to a human being empowered by Christ to give you absolution. Now, Bellarmine gives a syllogism. Now, watch the logic. The major premise. See, there are two premises and then a conclusion. The first premise. Those who find themselves burdened with grievous sin are held by divine law to do penance for their sin and seek to be reconciled with God. This is Bellarmine reasoning to the necessity of confession of sin. So number one, remission requires penance. Second, now he's going to substantiate these premises, his first statement. Second, the means necessary to obtain this reconciliation or perform this penance after baptism is to make confession to the priest of all mortal sins committed. And this, of course, is the top one to prove, but this is the argumentation. But penance equals confession. See what he's doing? He is specifying penance in the generic sense of something you don't want to do to expiate. Something you pay as a price for your having sinned. Third, conclusion, therefore, those who are in grave sin after baptism are held by the law of God to confess their sins. So, therefore, see, remission equals confession. Acts, summary, see. Now just to get a taste for his logic, we can't go into this is a whole theology by itself. The first premise, he says, the business of no remission without penance
without reconciliation, without doing something, he is almost too evident to be proved, as may be gathered from such statements of Christ as do penance. Unless you do penance, you shall all likewise perish. And he says nobody questions that. I mean, nobody questions that if a person has sins, he's supposed to do something to be reconciled. The whole problem, he says, however, rests on the second premise, which, for the sake of clarity, he reduces to another syllogism. So number two there, he will make into another syllogism. And the major premise is, Christ made his priests. Now, of course, once you say that, you're in the sympathy with Catholicism. Christ made his priests judges over the earth, giving them such power that without their pronouncement of a sentence in the matter, no one who has fallen into sin after baptism can be reconciled to God. In other words, that Christ gave to his apostles and through them to their successors power over sin. See? Somehow he gave them power over sin. Second, but the apostles and their successors cannot pass a correct judgment upon a man unless they are informed of his sins. And that's the crux of the matter, see? So just repeat. He's got the structure down, and the big thing is to prove that the kind of penance you're supposed to perform is to tell your sins. And if that isn't penance, nothing is. Now the full question is, what kind of penance? To prove that, he sets up another syllogism. Christ appointed his apostles and their successors as judges over sin. But they cannot pass judgment unless they know what it's all about, what kind of sins the person committed. Therefore, it is the will of God that all those who have sinned after baptism so confess their sins. Now, when it comes to the business of number one, the fact that the apostles and their successors, that's the real problem, see? That they have such power over sins. Then he appeals to three texts from the Bible, from the New Testament. And they are the three classic texts on which Catholicism rests its case for confession. Assuming that if they have the power of judgment, see, they must know what to judge, and therefore the person must reveal himself. The three passages are, first in Matthew 16:19, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind up on earth will be bound in heaven, loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Given to Peter, but through him also to others. Second, speaking to all the apostles, whatsoever you shall bind upon earth, same thing but now in Matthew 18:18. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So first to Peter, then to all the apostles. And third, and this is the crucial one, when Catholics believe Christ instituted the sacrament of confession. After his resurrection, he appeared to the apostles in the upper chamber in Jerusalem and said, as the Father sent me, I send you. Receive you the Holy Spirit. Whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven them. Whose sins you will not forgive or retain, they are retained or not forgiven. And that is John 20, verses 21 to 23. Then he keeps milling his logic. See? Then, to show that these texts are not just, you might say, superadded, a kind of a stuffing to a practice which had been, you might say, usurped into the Christian church, he goes to the church's practice down the centuries. And he has all kinds. He appeals to various writers, early writers, and the one on whom he rests the most is a contemporary of Augustine by the name of John Chrysostom. And mainly from his book on the priesthood. This is John Chrysostom's treatise on the priesthood. And here, for example, is Chrysostom quoted by Bellarmine. What then has he given but all power in heaven Whose sins, he says, you forgive, they are forgiven them. And whose sins you retain, you are retained. What power could be greater than this? So then he says, if a king were to bestow upon any of his subjects the power of casting into prison and of liberating whom he pleased, such a man would be envied and reverenced by all. And when a man receives from God a power so much greater than this, as heaven is above earth and the soul above body, is it possible to conceive of a greater gift? In other words, what he's doing is he's achieving a comparison of some kind of authority to pass judgment. Then, of course, God, and God alone forgives, but he uses. There's the point. Then Godwin goes on to say, that those who are scandalized over such power in the church should look at civil society, where civil society, by definition, recognizes unless you delegate authority to a judge to pass sentence, the case is heard, he sentences the person, say, to prison, or releases him, acquits him, and society believes that he is sanctioned by God. It is not just a human being. Nobody is right-minded to think that human judge has a right to sentence anybody to prison. But because of the necessity of maintaining right order, there must be someone delegated by God who exercises that power. That's the way government and general argues. Finally, on ambition. This was the whole problem of whether or not confession is effective of remission, where the person simply fears God's just punishments. Now, Calvin particularly opposed that on the score that it was unworthy of man, that it made of a man a slave. Now, Bellarmine argues, and this is crucial because in teaching, as I do, of course, the sacrament of penance in theology, I point out to the young priests, to be sure to point out to the people, that it is not a question merely of a Catholic getting into the habit of going to confession, and that because this person is a Catholic, therefore, he ought to go to confession. But there is behind this sacrament, from the Catholic viewpoint, a benefit, an advantage, which is really it's a boon, it's a gift, so that along with an admitted, well, penance and having to tell your sins, you'd much rather keep it to yourself or talk to God in the secrecy of your heart, along with that, you might say, disadvantage, is a great advantage. And the advantage, and if I tell them, if you miss this, you've missed the great benefit of penance that people ought to see. The great benefit is that the dispositions requisite for obtaining remission are the barest, absolute minimum. That whereas outside of the sacrament of confession, you can surely, Catholic, by the way,